The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Riley Herbst from 2311 Racing here. And you know what grinds my gears? Waiting for coffee. But instead of counting frappes and lattes, I fire up Chumba Casino. No apps, no fuss, just fun social casino games to pass the time. By the time my coffee's ready,
order for Riley.
I've already taken a few victory laps. Next time you're stuck waiting, make it entertaining. Play for free at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Michael Steele Podcast. Well, settle back for this conversation. I think you're going to enjoy this quite a bit. I'm joined today by Andy Borowitz. He's a satirist, New York Times bestselling author, and a comedian who has written for The New Yorker since 1998 and is the creator of The Borowitz Report, which is a wonderfully satirical news column that you can catch in The New Yorker. He's written a book entitled Profiles in Ignorance, How America's Politicians Got Dumb and Dumber. And he gets into examining the ignorant leaders who have endangered our country and how sometimes are we just a little bit ignorant in electing them. It's a great conversation. I hope you will enjoy it. So stick around and stay tuned for a little bit of satirical fun with Andy Borowitz right after this. Well, everybody, I hope you just settle back and get ready for what I think will be a just delightful conversation with Andy Borowitz, who has written a hell of a funny book, insightful book, and I think important in ways that are that some may think are subtle, but I think you're really upfront about this idea around these profiles of ignorance. How ignorant are our politicians? I've been saying this for years. As someone who's dealt with these people, and admittedly, it was one myself. I tried never to be an ignorant politician, but you waste no time in sort of setting the stage in the book. I loved it. Let's just so folks get a sense of where we're going here. You start and you go, imagine a hypothetical job applicant. He can't spell the simplest words such as heel and tap. Confused by geography, he thinks there's an African country called Namibia. As American history, he's under the impression that Andrew Jackson, who died in 1845, was angry about the Civil War, and that Frederick Douglass, who died in 1895, is still alive. Given the alarming state of his knowledge, you might wonder what job he could get. Unfortunately, he's not hypothetical, and he got the job in 2016, President of the United States. There's so much just in that opening that speaks volumes of, to me as someone who has worked with candidates, trained candidates, developed them, myself included, to always be one step ahead of your audience, your constituents, in what your knowledge base, your understanding, your empathy, those types of things. You just break it down and basically said, that doesn't even qualify anymore. It doesn't matter. What is it that you think voters are looking for today that allows such profiles of ignorance to actually take hold and win elections?
Well, that's a big question, and I'll try not to give a glib answer. But I really focus in the book on the last 50 years. Mm-hmm. And the reason why I focus on that, more or less, is because those are the 50 years that really saw the rise in television and mass media and the internet in the world of politics. So we've always had dumb politicians.
Right.
We've always had ill-informed politicians. We go back through American history and we can look at James Buchanan and Millard Fillmore and the know-nothing party and go through history and say, well, we've had a lot of presidents who didn't know that much. But in the last 50 years, because of the rise of TV and mass media, it's become more important to be a good performer in the media than to know stuff. And so we as Americans, it's funny, years ago I interviewed a writer named Larry Gelbart, who was famous for creating the TV series MASH, and is great sitcom writer, movie writer. And I was asking him about reality TV. This was about 20 years before Donald Trump was elected president. And I said, what do you think is the problem with reality TV? Is it harmless? Is it harmful? What do you think? And he said something very astute. He said, the problem is we're training the audience. And what he meant was we're training the audience. We're giving them certain expectations about what television should be. I don't think what Larry knew was that we were also giving them certain expectations about what our leaders should be. So if you look at my story, really begins with Ronald Reagan getting elected governor in 1966 and kind of ends with Donald Trump and the Trump wannabes who followed him. And one thing that Trump and Ronald Reagan had in common, and this drives liberals crazy when I say this, they're both supremely talented on television.
Yes.
No question about it. Yeah. And I even make the argument in my book that if you look at the statistics, you know, Donald Trump is fond of pointing out how great his Nielsen's were. That's one thing he was right about. He's not very good at things like COVID statistics, but when it comes to Nielsen ratings, he's very knowledgeable.
Right.
And he actually was more successful on television than Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan was on a show called the General Electric Theater on CBS, and that lasted about 8 years. And Trump lasted 14 seasons on The Apprentice. So he almost doubled Reagan's achievement. But that's really the problem, Michael, because in the years before we had TV and mass media and social media, we didn't really know how good our presidential candidates or our senatorial candidates were at performing. Maybe we were lucky enough to get a ticket to the Lincoln-Douglas debates.
Right.
We got to catch that. But in terms of the masses of American voters, we had to rely on, you know, information to the extent that it was available to us, what candidates knew, what their positions were. We didn't get to see them boiled down to a 2-minute soundbite on mass media. And so that's really what's different. And so now you have people, and we just saw this in the midterms, people like Dr. Oz, promoted as a senatorial candidate. As much as I like to make fun of Dr. Oz, he was certainly no more absurd a candidate than Donald Trump was. If anything, maybe he's more qualified because it doesn't seem like it, but he's an actual doctor.
He's an actual doctor, right?
He really is a doctor. And Herschel Walker, who was a running back for the New Jersey Generals, which is a team owned by Donald Trump in the long forgotten USFL. Again, somebody we were used to seeing on TV for many years, you know, tearing off great runs in the NFL. So I think in terms of what we're looking for in a candidate, we're kind of looking for the wrong things now. We're looking for entertainment, performance, how telegenic somebody is.
I was going to ask you that, because if they don't care about their intellect of their candidates, what is it that they're looking for instead? So if I take someone like a Carrie Lake in running for governor of Arizona, a Dr. Oz running for the U.S. Senate in Pennsylvania, and a Herschel Walker running for the U.S. Senate in Georgia, what are the three things, what are the things that, in your view, may connect those three types of candidates? And what is it about the voters? I mean, particularly with respect to the intellectual piece, you got a sliding scale there, in my view.
And how
do voters weigh that now in this age of social media, TikTok, 30-second sound bites, and so forth?
Well, the three of them have one big thing in common, which is that they're all very successful in the sense of being mass media figures.
Right.
Now, I would say you have to break it down a little bit. If we can unpack this a little bit. Herschel Walker is really great on television until he starts talking. It was great when he was running.
Wait. So otherwise, he's better off just standing there with his mouth shut.
Yeah. Or, you know, if you want to go on, you know, go on YouTube and watch the greatest runs of Herschel Walker and his unbelievable juking on the field. He's great at that. So he is, he's an entertainer. Athletes are entertainers.
Right.
He's a great entertainer. Dr. Oz is an entertainer. He's an example of this new phenomenon that I talk about in the book, where you have people who are actually genuinely smart. He's a genuinely smart guy, an esteemed doctor, who now is pretending to be dumber than he is. I mean, when he does, you know, when he tells us that magic coffee beans are going to cure our weight issues.
Right.
He is a graduate of medical school. He knows that's not the case. And in fact, he was sued for fraud for the things he said on the Dr. Oz show, and he had to pay out. So it's a very expensive charade that he's involved in.
Right.
Although he's gotten paid millions of dollars to be Dr. Oz on TV. But he's okay. So you've got a TV running back. He's really good at running. You've got a TV doctor who's good at dispensing fraudulent information. And then Carrie Lake is a TV newscaster who's great at reading from a teleprompter and is wonderful. She has something in common with Ronald Reagan and with Donald Trump, which is that they're all three of them are great at looking down the barrel of a TV camera and seeming sincere. I mean, people don't usually use the words Donald Trump and sincere in the same sentence. But when he said in 2015, I will build a great wall, and said that, millions of people believed him. And that's what makes him so effective. He's not just some loser, some idiot who gets on TV. He's very talented at looking down the barrel of the camera. And Ronald Reagan did that too. Now, you know, it's interesting where we've come to a sort of a scary place now is that in Ronald Reagan's era in 1966, this was the dawn, as I see it, of this whole development of the age of ignorance. And Ronald Reagan was widely considered a joke, sort of the way Herschel Walker is now. Like people thought, oh, he's just an actor and kind of a has-been hack actor. And when people first heard that he was thinking of running for governor of California, it was considered a joke. In fact, I quote this in the book, but Jack Warner, the famous movie mogul, was told that Ronald Reagan was thinking of running for governor. And he said, Ronnie for governor? No, Jimmy Stewart for governor, Ronnie for best friend.
Right.
But that was sort of, he was really considered very much third tier. But what was different about those days was that Ronald Reagan didn't know very much, but the people handling him, and you talked about how you would prepare candidates to run, he had a bunch of pros around him, like Stu Spencer, who you probably know. And Stu Spencer was one of the early campaign managers to figure out that you could use the techniques of advertising and PR to promote a candidate, which is now so commonplace, but it wasn't in the mid-60s. And Stu Spencer realized that you would have to really do a makeover on Ronald Reagan to make him not a joke. And so he hired some UCLA psychologists. This sounds like it's made up, but it's not. And they did this kind of Clockwork Orange experiment with Ronald Reagan, where they just poured information into him, and they created these 5x8 laminated cue cards that they put into a binder. And he memorized them. And the good news about Ronald Reagan was he was really good at memorizing stuff because that was his day job. Right. He was an actor.
Right. He had to memorize his lines,
But the difference between Reagan and our current crop is that he tried to sound smart. The whole point of this exercise was to make him seem well-informed enough that he could seem like a plausible gubernatorial candidate. And now that's really gone out the window, because now you have people like Dr. Oz, who is smart, and he's trying to sound dumb.
So how did you, that's a very interesting transformative process to go from someone who's outside of politics, who wants to be smart about politics. I mean, look, I mean, running government, state government especially, is a very complicated process. And you need to understand budgets. You need to understand the dynamics of your Department of the Environment and so forth. So there's a lot of stuff you need to know. And so Reagan wanting to at least sound smart about those things, even though I'm just a B Hollywood actor who thinks he can be governor. I can play that part, but I need to sound like I can play that part.
Exactly. But
today you have, to your point, candidates who are running who really don't give a rat's ass about any of that information or having that bank of knowledge of how to actually run the government. They're not out there trying to tell you, look, I'm actually going to get the stoplights on the corner to work. I'm actually going to have our environmental department look at the impact on the Chesapeake Bay. I'm going to act. They're just dumbing it down.
Right.
Put it this way. They're dumbing us down.
Right.
So our expectations aren't that you really need to know how to run state or federal government.
You know, you made a really insightful point there when you said they're dumbing us down. Because one thing that I have come to in studying ignorance, and I've probably lost many brain cells in the course of this research, just rereading all this stuff. But one thing I learned, you know, we used to hear a lot about, and we still hear about it from some conservatives. We hear this term trickle down.
Yes.
Economics. I don't think trickle down economics has been proved to work. It's been tried again and again. But I will say that trickle down ignorance does work, which is that if we have leaders who are ignorant and they're saying ignorant things, we as social animals tend to want to believe what our leaders are saying. We don't, you know, we act like we're so sarcastic and skeptical and cynical, but we're really not. We're really looking for guidance. So like after 9/11, when Tom Ridge got up there with his color-coded threat levels, which were kind of absurd, we did say like, oh no, we're on orange today. We buy into this.
We bought into it.
Yeah. So
is that because we find it easier to digest it and less complicated? Not so much in an intellectual way, but I guess maybe so, to the extent that when I see it, I know what it means. I don't have to think about it. In other words, you want to go to that space because of the weight of what it means, you know, these threat levels. If I can just get it to a point where if I see a red card, I know, okay, I need to duck. If I see an orange card, all right, I can go into the kitchen and get some water. It's okay, you know, that kind of deal.
Well, you're right in that, you know, I hadn't really thought about it before, but the threat levels were the ultimate product of television, because if we lived in a pre-television age, that never would have worked.
Right.
We had to have a guy standing up there with like the color-coded things as crazy as they were. But yeah, I mean, I think that the dumbed down messages, whether it's today we're orange or we're going to build a wall, these are all visuals. And Ronald Reagan was great at visuals. He would talk about the shining city on the hill, right?
One of my favorite speeches, which I quote all the time.
It's a great speech. It doesn't tell us much about how we're going to get to that, or it's morning in America, like that.
Another one of my favorites. Yeah, as I said, you deconstructed a lot of Reagan for me.
Well, he understood the medium very well. Now, here's a good example of the alternative. You talked about how you need a politician who understands how they're going to fix things and how to. Now, back in the 1930s, when we had the Dust Bowl, we fortunately had a president like that, because FDR was dealing with this environmental crisis, the likes of which we'd never faced before. It's a little bit like climate change today, and then it's a man-made environmental crisis. He didn't know how to fix it. So what he did is he surrounded himself with experts, and he listened to what they had to say about irrigation, and he was intellectually curious. And so he was able to, and intellectually humble, because he said, like, I don't know.
Right.
So I'm going to surround myself with smarter people. And they came up with solutions and they fixed it. Now, nowadays, if you look to like the 2020 race, we had a candidate like Elizabeth Warren, one of our smartest politicians today. But she made a fatal mistake, which is her slogan when she was running for president was, I've got a plan for that.
Right.
Americans do not want a plan. We want stories. We want stories. We want visuals. We want the shining city on a hill. But we, you know, when I think about a plan, I think about when you get your annual auto insurance summary from right. your insurance company. Do you ever read that plan, Michael? I don't read that plan.
Look, the only thing I look at is how much it costs. And the only thing I look at is I go right to the page. Okay, how much am I paying?
That's right. That's right. There is no, we do not like plans, but no, it's human nature. If you can come up with a slogan, a dumbed down slogan, we will follow you to the ends of the earth. And what sort of happened, you know, I sort of went from the example of what I call the ridicule stage, where you have like Ronald Reagan.
Let's do that. I'm glad you opened up that door, because I wanted to get into the meat of the book, because I just love the way you broke it down. You basically break this idea of ignorance into three stages.
Yes.
Ridicule, acceptance, and celebration.
Yes.
So walk us through each of those stages so we can realize just how ignorant we all are.
And it is trickling down. It's not our fault.
That's right. Let's start with ridicule.
Okay. So the ridicule phase, which I alluded to earlier, was a time when ignorant politicians like a Ronald Reagan or, God forbid, Dan Quayle, ignorant politicians had to pretend to be smart. And this worked great with Ronald Reagan because he was great at learning those lines. It did not, unfortunately, work so well with our friend Dan Quayle, because Dan Quayle lacked that talent to appear smart. Whenever he was asked a question that he didn't know, he would struggle and he would get kind of huffy. And you could tell, oh my God, he's absolutely hopeless. But he was also, much like Ronald Reagan, the people surrounding him were hoping that he was going to be a great product of television, because they were under the impression that he was just the most handsome guy on earth.
Right, he was telegenic, right.
Yeah, they thought he looked like Robert Redford, and he was incredibly sexy. I should say that this observation was made almost entirely by Republican men. So it's like, if you're going to determine how sexy a guy is to women, really good idea to invite a woman into the room.
Right. And ask
her what she thinks. I realize there weren't as many Republican women advisors in the year 1988 as there are now, but that was sort of a fatal mistake. So that was the ridicule phase. Now, what was interesting about this phase was it was a time where we as American people, as you point out, we still wanted our politicians to be well-informed. So that was the expectation. So if you were ignorant, you had to pretend to be well-informed. Right. Now, a pivot occurred when we got into what I call the acceptance phase, which is, in acceptance, ignorance started becoming more of an asset, in that ignorance could be embraced, it could be sort of touted, because it made you, the candidate, seem more authentic, more like a regular guy, more like somebody you would want to have a beer with, if that sounds familiar. So. Right. The father of the acceptance phase, as I see it, was George W. Bush, because Bush was really not that different from Quayle in terms of how much he actually knew. In fact, in the book, I have a quiz called Bush or Quayle, where I challenge the reader to tell them apart. And it's harder than you think.
It's harder than you think, people. Trust me, it is. Yeah,
it is. But neither of them were big fans of the printed word. They didn't like to read very much. Didn't know a lot, but George Bush did something really smart, or his advisors. I suspect this mainly came from Karl Rove, who was a very shrewd guy. George W. Bush, very early in his campaign in 2000, it was actually the year 1999, was ambushed by a Boston TV reporter named Andy Hiller. And what Andy Hiller liked to do was he liked to subject politicians to kind of a lightning round, where he would ask them a bunch of questions to see how many they would get wrong. And so he asked George W. Bush to name the heads of state of four different countries that were kind of controversial. There were sort of hot spots at the moment. And Bush only got one out of four correct, which should have been like a Dan Quayle moment where he was absolutely finished. But instead, what George Bush did that was very clever was that his head of communications, Karen Hughes, got out in front of the press and she said, George W. Bush is running for president of the United States, not Jeopardy contestant. So it was an interesting statement. It was very anti-intellectual, anti-knowledge, but also made a really weird suggestion that the president of the United States did not have to know as much as somebody on Jeopardy. I would actually argue that the president of the United States should maybe know more than a person on Jeopardy, because he has more at stake in terms of our lives and our
security. So let's I don't want to take you off that trail, but I do want to take a little sidebar on that, because sure. In that portion of the book where you do the Bush-Quayle test, it really got me thinking about this idea of, and you really just put your finger on it, is the expectation that our presidents should know more than we should know, when in fact, those are individuals who generally aren't privy to the things that a president gets to know until they become president. No one, I can almost guarantee you, unless you are working in the space, you could take any members on Capitol Hill right now and ask them, okay, name me four leaders of four countries. If they're not on foreign affairs or Senate intelligence, right? If they're not working in that space, I would almost bet you they probably get two. I mean, they probably couldn't tell you who the new prime minister of Great Britain is right now.
Right.
Mr.
Sinek. Right. And by the way, Michael, it's very hard to keep track of who the prime minister.
That's the other thing. Yes, it does seem to be a little bit of a revolving door over here at the moment, but we're settling. So how do we now reprocess this particular aspect of our candidates, our elected leaders, in terms of what we think they should know versus what they actually know coming into these jobs?
That's a really very nuanced question. So I really appreciate that. I actually don't expect every candidate running for office to know it all. I mean, I think probably of our recent presidents, probably Bill Clinton might have been the wonkiest. Like, he might have been the most steeped in trivia and like the could talk, you know, could if you named like one country like Sri Lanka, he could probably give you an hour on Sri Lanka.
Right.
I'm not so sure that that's as important as what I referred to earlier about FDR, which is intellectual curiosity. Which, by the way, Bill Clinton also had. That's how you get to be knowledgeable, because you're initially intellectually humble. You say, I don't know this stuff. That sparks your intellectual curiosity. And then you do a couple things. You read a lot and you surround yourself with people who know more than you do. So I get suspicious when we have politicians, and George W. Bush was a good example of this, who would kind of openly say, I don't know very much. I didn't read a whole book in college. Somebody who didn't read much in college is probably not going to read a presidential daily brief either.
And that's
a concern to me.
That's some thick reading.
That 2 to 3 page item. And to me, you know, Sarah Palin, who is another person I put in that acceptance phase, because she made the fact that she wasn't a reader and she wasn't a scholar, although she did attend many, many colleges.
Yes.
But the fact that she was not a reader and didn't know very much, she really made that a quality that was relatable. She said, like in her debate with Joe Biden when she was running for vice president, she said, I may not answer all the questions you have for me, but I'm going to talk straight to the American people and Joe Sixpack and all the hockey moms across America. And it's great. Talk straight. We love that. But don't answer any questions. A debate is supposed to be all about answering questions.
But that's where a lot of Americans found themselves too. I would bet you in many respects, Andy, that a lot of folks, when they saw and heard a Sarah Palin, when they had that, you know, guy at the end of the bar moment with George Bush, they saw a little bit of themselves there. So you have this sort of setup between the intellectual elites and the rest of us. And you see that, you almost see that chasm being created in the 90s and expanded in the early 2000s. And when you got to someone like Donald Trump, It all just kind of blew up. People don't care. You hear people say, "I don't care." He just, you know, when I have a, for example, a little example I always give of the white suburban mother of two from New Hampshire, when asked about Donald Trump, why she liked him, her response was, "Because he's just like me."
Right.
And right. That's that thing, that acceptance connection, where the public begins to accept these people because they see them more like them.
Right. And Sarah Palin, by the way, I think has been very misremembered by elites like me, for example, because when a lot of people in the media remember Sarah Palin, they're really remembering Tina Fey.
Yes.
They're remembering Sarah Palin as a figure of ridicule. So like Tina Fey said, as Sarah Palin, she said, "I can see Russia from my house." Most people, if you ask them, think that Sarah Palin actually said
never it. Said it.
She never said such a thing. She did say a true statement, which is, it is possible to see Russia from Alaska, from the Bering Straits. It is possible.
It is possible. Yes.
But she never said anything as concise as, "I can see Russia from my house." Most of her sentences would run 200 to 300 words. So you know that can't be a Sarah Palin quote. But Sarah, I really was fascinated when I was researching the book to watch a focus group that Frank Luntz, the Republican pollster, did for Fox News after that Biden debate with Sarah Palin. And the people in the focus group said exactly what you just said, Michael, which is, they said, "Sarah Palin is everyday America. She's mainstream America. Yep. She's no different from anybody." I make the argument, and this is just my thing, and I'm sure some people agree with me. I actually want the president of the United States to be smarter than I am. I do not want somebody just like me. The idea of a president being just like me is terrifying to me because I know what a bad job I would do.
Yeah, me too.
I like the idea of somebody being in the Oval Office, a man or a woman, who will say, I don't know as much as the experts. I better get some experts in here, and I better read some books, and I better really get some knowledge to deal with these crises, rather than doing what Donald Trump did, which was say, "I know more than the generals. I know more than the scientists." I mean, the idea that Donald Trump would get on TV for the coronavirus task force meeting from the White House and just start riffing his cures to the COVID crisis. You know, yeah, maybe drinking or injecting bleach would do it, or maybe putting light inside the body. He's got people like Dr. Fauci and Deborah Birx on stage who actually do this stuff. And instead he's up there riffing. But
the thing is, Andy, people actually tried to do it.
They did. That's what I mean by trickle-down ignorance. They wanted to believe that Donald Trump was their leader, that he knew things. And you can understand why, because one thing I won't do, and I don't do it in the book, is I don't demonize the American people.
Right.
You know, we have democracy, and the only hope for democracy is if we occasionally make the right decision as a people. So there's people who just say, we have dumb politicians because voters are dumb. I say, like, well, then we're really screwed. If you really think that we're all dumb, then we're screwed, because democracy is based on the voice of the people. I think that's what I learned. It's like, I think it's from Greek or something like that.
Right.
So
right.
If we just think that we're all so irreparably dumb, that we're just like dumb leaders, then we're screwed. We've got to believe that we can be convinced to vote for smart people. And I actually think, Michael, that the recent midterms offered a glimmer of hope, because I feel like the wackiest, craziest candidates for Secretary of State, for governor and for these offices, it really didn't make it through. There was like, we had this kind of breaking system where we're all like, wait a minute, no, this has gone too far.
We're having a great conversation with Andy Borowitz in his new book, Profiles in Ignorance, How America's Politicians Got Dumb and Dumber. Andy, we're going to take a quick slide out for a moment. When we come back, we want to get into celebration.
Yeah.
And how that plays into the dumbing down of our political process. We'll have more with Andy right after this.
Retaliation with Julie Roginski is a weekly podcast focused on the stories of women who have spoken truth to power and have persevered despite the costs. It shares the experiences of courageous people who have sometimes been celebrated, but too often castigated for standing up for themselves and for others. Each week, I examine the structures, systems, and culprits responsible for perpetuating and promoting workplace toxicity. You'll hear stories from female celebrities, music label executives, politicians, police officers, and many others as we examine the cultural reevaluations, policy changes, and legal steps that can finally bring an end to the ongoing attack on women in this country and around the world. Listen on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Michael Steele Podcast. I told you it was going to be an enjoyable conversation with Andy Borowitz, New York Times bestselling author and a comedian who has written a very, very good book. One of the things I said, Andy, about this period that we're in is that the political scientists, the psychologists, and the psychiatrists are the ones who are going to have to write the story and help us understand it. Also, the comedians are going to have to write the story, and you have in your book Profiles in Ignorance. Before we went to the break, we were talking about at least two of the three stages of ignorance, and we talked a little bit about ridicule. We were talking about acceptance. Tell us about celebration.
Okay, so just to recap, for those who are with short attention spans, which
yes,
I know.
Which I'm one too.
Exactly. So ridicule was dumb politicians pretending to be smart. Acceptance was dumb politicians being proud of being dumb and embracing their ignorance. Now we're in celebration, which is the phase we're in now, and we've gone completely through the looking glass. And in celebration, smart politicians have to pretend to be dumb. Now, when I use the word smart and dumb, just let me be a little specific because we have to define our terms. By smart, I mean well-informed politicians right. Who learn things, know things, have a certain
all those politicians who went to Harvard and Yale.
We have a lot of them. We have a lot of them, although you would not know it.
Who sound dumb as a bag of bricks.
Exactly. And when I say dumb, I mean ignorant. They right. don't know things. So we now have this weird spectacle, and it was very much, I think, typified by Donald Trump, although I think it was starting certainly before the advent of Trump. There's a moment in the book where I talk about the 2012 CPAC conference, mm-hmm. the Conservative Political Action Committee. And it was memorable for a couple of things. One is Mitt Romney, who was running for president that year, came out and said two very unconvincing things. One, he said that he was, in his words, severely conservative. Now, I mean, when you say severely conservative, that suggests that you're trying a little too hard. Because
just a bit.
A little bit, because most conservatives don't think being conservative is a severe thing. I think it's like, that's a good thing to be. So he said he was severely conservative, but then the other thing he said, and I'm just sort of paraphrasing, he was talking about all the young activists in the audience, and he said, they know people like Hegel and Burke and people like that who they were, and when I was their age, you know, you could have fooled me if I didn't think that they were, you know, infielders for the Detroit Tigers. Now, okay, let's just stop for a second here. Mitt Romney is one of our best educated, smartest politicians in recent memory. He was yes. valedictorian of his class. He had a combined JD MBA, I think, from Harvard.
That's correct.
He is not some rube. Okay. He was trying to act rubish. And I think it was a really interesting and kind of ominous development, because here was a guy who was super smart, and he was now positioning himself as sort of like somebody who just, you know, fell off a turnip truck or something. Mm-hmm. And I think this was, in a way, a prophetic moment, because he was suggesting this was the direction we were going to go in, where smart guys like him were going to now have to pretend to be dumb in order to be relatable and electable. Now, what happened with Donald Trump, who is really the undisputed icon of the celebration phase, he really positioned himself as a guy who was not an expert. Mm-hmm. But he said he knew more than any of the experts. As I said, he knew more than the generals. He said he knew more about renewables than anybody. He reeled off all this, these claims about how brilliant he was, but he had actually no credentials and no information. The only credentials he had really pertained to his quote unquote success as a real estate developer. And as he was presented on The Apprentice, which was a brilliant piece of TV myth-making, he did seem all-knowing. He seemed like, you know, the Obi-Wan Kenobi of capitalism. He was sitting in that high back chair and he was just sort of shooting from the hip and saying, you're fired and that's bad and all of this. So it was almost like a magic eight ball. You know, he just was like shooting out these decisions, but there didn't seem to be any kind of deliberative process or any kind of knowledge behind it. It was just pure unadulterated arrogance. Now, Donald Trump and some of his acolytes like Lauren Boebert and Marjorie Taylor Greene, I must say they come by their ignorance very honestly.
Yes.
Genuinely uninformed people. But there's this whole other crew that you alluded to who are the true, I would say, the true icons or examples of the celebration phase, who are supremely well-educated, usually from Ivy League colleges or universities, but are pretending to be as dumb as Donald Trump. Case in point, Harvard and Yale graduate Ron DeSantis.
Yes.
Now, Ron DeSantis, you would not know it to hear him talk when he says Florida is the place where woke came to die or whatever that nonsense was. He's trying very hard to be populist and to sound uninformed, but he's an extremely well-informed guy. So well-informed, in fact, that when it came to the coronavirus pandemic, he did two things that show both how smart he is and also how dumb he pretends to be. He's very smart in that he actually is a big believer in statistics because as governor of Florida, he did a lot to suppress the statistics when they didn't make Florida look very good.
Yeah.
So in terms of vaccination, he got vaccinated. He made sure that his kids got vaccinated. He wasn't saying vaccinations are bad. But he appointed as the Surgeon General of Florida a sort of quote unquote doctor. He actually is a real doctor who was suggesting that we all take horse medicine, ivermectin, mm-hmm. to cure our coronavirus. So he's a guy who in his own life is smart, well-informed, but in terms of his public facing self, he's trying to present this populist, uninformed version of himself. So uninformed and so recklessly uninformed that he was actually banned from YouTube for spreading vaccination misinformation. Now, I don't know if you've been on YouTube lately, but if you look at what's still on YouTube,
yeah, right.
It's hard to imagine what you have to say to get banned from YouTube. Right. So he's an example of this. Josh Hawley, another example, Yale Law School grad who wouldn't certify the Electoral College votes when it came time to do that in the Senate. Now, Josh Hawley knows that there was no fraud. He's a smart guy. He is an election denial. The public facing self of him is, but when it came to taking a test at Harvard Law School, I'm pretty sure that Josh Hawley would have given the correct answer when it came to whether or not the electoral system had been somehow violated mysteriously. So he's another one. You know, Matt Gaetz went to William and Mary. You can just go down the list of these. Ted Cruz, Princeton graduate. So I don't mean to sound, I actually did go to an Ivy League school. So what I'm sounding like is an elitist who's equating Ivy League education with knowledge, which is not the case. There's tons of stuff I don't know. And I certainly went to school with a lot of people who didn't know very much. But the fact of the matter is, these people are all hiding the fact that they're educated. They're working overtime to sound uninformed. And that's what the celebration phase is about. It's at a point where we are elevating stupidity and ignorance over expertise. And that's not a society's recipe for success.
So these individuals in the celebration phase, the Josh Hawleys who, you know, with the raised fist, but then we see the clip of him running like a, you know, little scared teenage girl.
Yes, Usain Bolt of the U.S. Senate. I know.
Right, the Usain Bolt of the U.S. Senate. What's their end game here? How are they capitalizing, or how do they intend to capitalize on this ignorance?
Well, in the case of Ron DeSantis, we don't know the end game yet, but the mid game is pretty good because he did very well in the midterms, and his populist message, his anti-trans, anti-gay, anti-science message is working up to a point. We'll see how far it gets him. I am very bad at making predictions.
Right.
But I think, one of the problems is, he lacks something that Donald Trump has, which is, I don't think he's talented. I don't think that he has Donald Trump's talent. I think Donald Trump's talent is somewhat degraded right now. If you saw his announcement,
right,
that's like, buying a later album by a band you used to like.
Right.
It's like he's lost his juice somehow. I don't like to be ageist because we're all getting older, but I think in Donald Trump's case, one of the problems is that what he always has had going for him is grievance. His sense of grievance is very authentic. Mm-hmm. The problem is when he started in 2015, his grievance, he found a way to transmute it into something that was relatable. He turned it into anger at immigration,
right,
and anger at Mexicans. And so he was able to turn into a nationalist, racist message. When your message of grievance is simply, I was denied election to president of the United States, that's something many fewer people can relate to. How many people really feel that they were denied election to the presidency? So he's lost a step, but I don't think that Ron DeSantis has much of a step. I don't think that he is telegenic. I think in this age where performance is so important, I don't think he has it. So it's going to be interesting to see whether his projection of stupidity is going to be enough to make that, to get him to the promised land. I have some doubts. I could be wrong, but
I actually kind of agree with you on that. And I've heard that from a number of people inside and outside of Florida that, he's pretty much, landlocked to Florida. He's not necessarily going to translate nationally the way other figures that we've discussed have, like Reagan and Trump. And certainly, as we've seen some of the other figures, whether for good or bad, Ted Cruz, Sarah Palin, translate across the country, outside of Alaska, outside of Texas. He really is kind of landlocked into the Florida sort of environment. So that
who he reminds me a little bit of, just in terms of his prospects, is Scott Walker.
Mm.
Remember 2016, everybody said Scott
Very
Walker
good point.
Had the Koch brothers behind him. He was kind of like the generic Republican right-wing candidate. He was white. He was from, Midwest. He had the Koch brothers. And he was like a lock. People thought, look out for Scott Walker. And he just, imploded on impact. He had nothing.
What does that tell you in light of what you've written in the book and the stages that we've seen these politicians go through and the American people get caught up in? What does that tell you, particularly in this age of social media? How does the next presidential candidate for the Democrats or the Republicans, sort of setting Biden and Trump aside for the moment?
Please.
Yeah.
Please let's set them aside.
Set them aside for the moment. When you're looking at that landscape, do you see someone who can pull us off of this ignorance track and actually re-intellectualize the presidency, re-intellectualize the curiosity of the American people in having someone who actually knows more than they do, as opposed to just being that guy or gal I can have a beer with, or who sounds like my Uncle Bob when he's at his, visiting a truck stop?
I wish I could tell you I have a candidate. And honestly, I would, as much as I've been historically a Democrat, I would love to see a Mitt Romney, emerge on the Republican side, who I could say, well, at least I can go to bed at night not feeling like the world's going to blow up if he were president, because I know he's well informed. I don't know if there's anyone on the horizon. I hope that there is, because I feel like we're ready to turn the page, perhaps.
Yeah, that's kind of the feeling I have too.
I feel like again, not to be ageist, but I just think about how taxing that job is, and it might be better to have somebody, I don't know, maybe in their 60s who right. can take it on. But I feel like, you know, if we look back a few years, somebody like Barack Obama, I feel like, is the right paradigm, in the sense that as far as the mass media goes, and, you know, the internet and social media and TV, you can't unring the bell. The problem that a lot of candidates right. have made in the past is saying, well, I'm just going to be super smart and I'm going to win because I'm the smartest, and I'm just not really going to pay attention to the demands of the mass media. It's too late for that. We're way too in too deep for that. Whoever's going to emerge from either party, in the best case scenario, is somebody who is intellectually curious and smart and well-informed, but doesn't flaunt it. I know it sounds like I'm urging people to dumb down their message, but the fact is Barack Obama did dumb down his message. In fact, in my book, I show that Samuel L. Jackson took him to task for that.
Yeah.
He said, like, stop trying to relate, you know, be effing presidential, as Samuel L. Jackson would say. You know, Obama was very much, in terms of his message, he was in the Reagan mold. He looked back.
That's where I was going to go, because I took note of that Samuel L. Jackson point, because for me, one of the things that Reagan did for me, beyond just the ideological political space, was that he affirmed my impression, my desires, I guess is the word. I'm trying to find the right word, but I'll go with impressions of what a president should be.
Yes.
Someone who, this book made me think about it from an intellectual standpoint, whether they're smart or not smart, et cetera, as well. But regardless of the intellect, and I think this is one of the appeals for someone like Roosevelt, even though he was a very smart man, mm-hmm. that wasn't the first thing that sort of brought you into the conversation. You could actually see him and feel him as president.
He was reassuring.
Reassuring,
and,
exactly.
And
that's what Reagan was. He was reassuring as president.
And what I show in the book is that Democrats really are still very much in love with Reagan in terms of his stagecraft and his presentation. Both Clinton and Obama looked to Reagan for inspiration. I mean, it was really funny because Republicans, when Clinton was running for re-election in 1996, Republicans were furious at him because he was just ripping off Reagan right and left. He was just doing It's Morning in America.
Right.
And throughout his presidency, I just love this fact about Bill Clinton. Every time he had to give a major speech, like at the 40th anniversary, you know, 50th anniversary of Normandy, he would send an aide to the Reagan Library to check out a video of Ronald Reagan's speech at the 40th. It was like, for him, the Ronald Reagan Library was like Blockbuster Video.
Yeah.
He would just send people for tapes of Reagan because Reagan was so good at that stuff. So what I'm saying is, we need somebody who is good on TV, who knows how to use social media the way Obama was a master of social media and the internet. Like he had so many smart people working that for him, and that's one of the reasons why he succeeded. But there's no reason why you can't have all that savvy about the media and still know what you're doing and still be intellectually curious. That's kind of that Goldilocks golden mean that I'm looking for. I don't know who's out there. I wish I could give you five names of people who are good at that, but that's right. why politics, you know, talented politicians are really few and far between. I'd love to find somebody who gets to be president, not by pretending to be stupid or by being stupid, but by actually being smart, but finding a way to communicate it in a way that it is, as you would say, or as I would say, reassuring and inspirational.
There it is. Well, I have to tell you, folks, Andy has written a very thought-provoking and intriguing book, funny, insightful. It helps you sort of put the last 50 years of our politics in a better perspective, I think, and understanding how the manipulations and how the conversations and how the images and all those things kind of work together. I talk about politics a lot, Andy, when I give speeches and if I'm teaching a class about, you know, how to win elections and lose the country.
Right.
And the losing the country part is what our politicians do. And which is what I love about this book is that it actually, if I were still teaching at Brown on this subject, your book would be required reading because it's the perfect complement to understanding exactly how these various narratives that politicians create are played out and how they know better but refuse to do better. Mm-hmm. Right. And so it's a very interesting, it's a fine line, but I think you've captured a lot of it for folks in a way that it's enjoyable reading. It's the kind of book that makes you go, it's the kind of book that, you know, yes, you deconstructed some of my Reagan images. I get it. I understand it. But it's important, though, for us to understand how we are where we are, why we're here now, and how we have allowed it to happen and how our politicians have contributed to it. So
that was the goal. I mean, one thing, and I'll just end with this, Michael, is that I talk a lot about intellectual curiosity and intellectual humility. And one thing that was really interesting for me about writing a book like this was learning about how many things I was ignorant about.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, for example, that education alone, like making our voters educated, that would fix all the problems. And actually it doesn't, because educated voters choose dumb politicians too. So find a way to do it. So it's interesting. I think the, you know, just so it doesn't sound too depressing, and I don't think the book is depressing, I think it's a hopeful book. But I do end on this note, which is that we all can play a role in terms of making our politics smarter. And as I said, ignorance trickles down, but knowledge can rise up. If we work locally to elect smarter politicians, even if it's like our town council or whatever, we're eventually building up a reservoir of talent that can rise up and take over the country and fix the problems that we all know face us.
Amen. Amen. The book is Profiles in Ignorance, How America's Politicians Got Dumb and Dumber. The author is the incredible Andy Borowitz, satirist, New York Times bestselling author and comedian. Check out Andy on Twitter at Borowitz Report. You also do a great deal of writing in The New Yorker. Check out his works there. You've been writing there since, I guess, the late 90s, right? So you've
1998.
My
first article was about Bill Clinton's talking points during the Monica Lewinsky scandal. So that's how far back I go.
There you go. Well, man, it's been a real pleasure having this conversation with you. I definitely appreciate you dropping by the podcast.
Same, Michael. Great to meet you.
Absolutely. That does it for our time together this week, folks. Love it when you have a chance to spend a moment or two with us. Don't forget to check us out on Twitter at Michael Steele and the podcast, Twitter at Steele_podcast. If you like this podcast, please tell a friend, share it, give us a shout out on Apple Reviews and on Apple Podcasts. I love it when you do the download thing, obviously, because it makes me feel all yummy inside. This is the season for giving. So until next time, take care, everybody. Be well.
All right, America, you asked for it. Or maybe you didn't. But either way, we have to talk. You're just in kind of a crazy place right now, Mr. and Mrs. USA. So we're going to sit down a couple of times a week and work it out between us. The way Americans do. On a podcast. Hosted by Beowulf Rocklin. Weird name. Weird news. Weird politics. Weird country. Facepalm America. available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No